Blog Talk Radio.
People continue to ask the question, what is going on? We know we look at the mass media, we see there are so many things going on, we're not quite sure what's that we're looking at. So tonight, to try to get a little bit of more clarity on what is going on, we have our ongoing political panelists today. We have with our brother Anthony Wim, brother Jabari Robinson, brother Haki Kamafi Muchoki, and we have with us Brother Moses. This is Africa on the Move political panelists, and they will share their views and perspectives on issues or what is going on, and we would like to just open up the mic first and foremost to our brother Jabari, and he will open up to the world his views on what is going on. Brother Jabari, welcome to Africa on the Move. From your world, what is going on, Brother Jabari?
As usual, thank you for having me in peace, brothers. And I wanted to just shed some light on how it's amazing to me that given the revenue and the prestige that comes with being involved in the sports world, it's not free from the plague of racism that, you know, plagues those that live in the U.S. Because I know recently one of the top drivers, Tony Stewart, keep in mind, in regards to reaching NASCAR circuit, one has to go through extensive training and prove he's capable of handling that car that can go up with something like 200 miles per hour. But recently he killed someone. He said it was by accident, but nonetheless he killed somebody, and there was no police investigation. Basically, NASCAR gave him like a 2-week break, and I find it very strange that this guy with a professional driver who was operating a race car could commit something like that, it makes me wonder if he wasn't having to be of European descent, what would have happened if that was a person of color that had did that, considering we don't have to do much of anything for, you know, law enforcement officials to kind of pull us over or investigate us, trying to figure out what we're doing or try to plan something on us. So, you know, I found it very strange that he's able to use white privilege and get off with killing a guy, and we can get in trouble for so much less. What's going on?
Anybody want to take a stab at it? I have my ideas, but I'll let some of my political panelists tonight take a stab at the question. The question is, what's going on as it relates to Tony Stewart, who is a race car driver, and he ended up killing someone. I guess it happened about 2-3 weeks ago, I believe. And also in terms of the case, it's not the first time he has hit people with cars and injured people. And I too, Jabari, wonder how he get away with these kind of crimes, and very little press really talk about it. Often we talk about there are two different criminal systems inside the border of the U.S., but it seems like there are more than two. It seems like there are multiple criminal systems. Depends on the status of the class that you're in, and that would determine the type of justice that you would get. But to my political analysts, anybody like to take a stab at that? What is going on? Why this man was not prosecuted? Why was there no investigation? How can you just kill someone, and just because you're a race car driver, you get away with murder? Literally speaking.
Well,
I'd like to take a stab at it. Oh, sorry. I think, bear in mind that this took place at a sporting event. And this society, sporting events are tend to be evaluated differently from other types of activity. And I think there's a class factor that comes into play here. Let's see, Tony Stewart, he's made a lot of money during the course of his career. And he's in the spotlight a lot. And my take on it is that the media is keeping it quiet so as not to damage the image of that sport. Even though I find it rather strange that there have been hundreds of Africans killed over much less.
Yeah, brother, you have to remind me of Darren Williams. I think it was Darren Williams. I know last name Williams, the one who played power forward for New Jersey Nets about 15 years ago. When he accidentally shot his driver, his chauffeur.
Jason Williams.
Correct. Did you see how they dealt with him? I mean, it was unbelievable. So, you know, I'm often wondering. But, Brother Haki, he has something you like. What's your take on that?
My position is that it goes a little bit deeper. One of the things, we can't divorce racism in sports. Now, there was a situation where quarterback for the Pittsburgh Steelers, Roethlisberger, on three different occasions was allegedly charged with rape of three different women. Now, the way the media handled that wasn't in the usual kind of way. It was more circumstantial. It was more circumstantial. It was more a sense of we got to be careful in terms of how we do that. And the question is, why is it that this particular alleged crimes have been handled differently? Because there was political nuance we had to take into consideration. One of the things that when we talk about the overall economy in terms of how the economy is deteriorating, one of the things that the system is very, very careful not to do is to actually to indict white people when white people commit crimes. In other words, there's a sort of coddling that takes place in terms of, in terms of white criminals, in the sense that we won't present you, as a criminal per se. We'll create a scenario that suggests that the situation as it relates to you maybe have been something that was unavoidable, but nonetheless understandable. So therefore, they're careful not to characterize white folks as criminals because they don't want white folks to begin to see the kind of injustices that inflicts African people also inflicts white people. in a very careful in terms of how the narrative is framed when it comes to white people. So now, if you, a situation where Africans, African football players, most recently Ray Rice out of the out of Baltimore with the Ravens, he was alleged to have assaulted his wife. Now, the characterization or the reporting of that event was totally different than when Rauschenberg, when he was the three women. When they talked about Ray Rice, it was more in line of, you know, that, in fact, criminality, the abuse of women is something just endemic, just natural to African athletes. And then when you ask the question, why is that? Why do they keep doing that? Well, it's important to understand, you know, the system has to have scapegoats. It has to have scapegoats in terms of what's going on economically. Even though African people dispossess, they oppress, they marginalize, and decide to have no control whatsoever over what's going on with the economy, someone has to take the blame. So what they're conveniently doing is making it possible that, in fact, when all things go wrong, it's a point to a black face. And it doesn't matter whether you're talking about sports or any other arena, that when the defendant or the alleged culprit is somehow a person of color, then the whole narrative is totally different than when they're white. But the reason they're doing it is because they understand clearly that given the current arrangement in terms of how the economy works, that this is not sustainable, and they understand that. And so, therefore, they're preparing for the inevitable. In order for them to maintain control, in order for the system to maintain its longevity or its equilibrium, it's important that you have a division that exists in the society against, you know, between black and white, so it makes it easier for purposes of control. In other words, you can pit one group against the other group and those in the ruling. So this is why it's important to portray all black folks, irrespective of circumstances, as somehow criminal-minded, whereas white people who commit crimes are not perceived as criminal per se, but seen as a sociological victim in which something happened was unfortunate, but, you know, it was just one of those kind of things that happened. So there's political considerations in terms of that, and we have to understand the role in terms of the powerful, in terms of propping up racism, and the powerful controls the media. So as long as they can control the narrative, they can control how people are perceived, and this is important. And one of the things, there's a term that we talk about the term called ignotology, which is the science in terms of tricking people. As they say in the street, they call it tricknology. That's an intimate part of the media in terms of not only dividing people, but to continue to create a narrative that suggests that African people are, in fact, the source of all the problems of society. And this is consciously done. It's not a coincidence that Tony Stewart got off with killing somebody. Now, if he had been an African person or a person of color, then that would have been totally different, because it raised the question in terms of, listen, as a driver, you know, that one of the things that you have to be cognizant of is, you know, what your vehicle is doing at all times. And so, therefore, there's a bit of irresponsibility on the part of Tony Stewart as a driver to act or run into somebody with a vehicle which he knows how to command as a race car driver. So we have to understand that a lot of the stuff that goes on in terms of that division that takes place between, you know, people of color and white people in terms of the nerve, then we have to understand that those in power want it that way, and they do it because they understand the nature of the beast and they understand the nature of the economy, and therefore they will be set up, you know, as convenient scapegoats for the future, and that's what that's all about.
Let me jump in here. You know, the most oppressed are the most revolutionary, and the black man is the most revolutionary. The white people fear black men. They have a black man phobia. They when they're shooting us, they're not shooting us because they're bad. They're scared. It's a weakness. It's a sickness. But there is such thing as black man phobia. It's character assassination. It takes place on a lot of levels. Things that would be normal are blown all out of proportion. It's a reaction that is unnecessary, but it's a phenomena that happens because we are all products of our condition and conditioning, and we live in a racist society.
Brother Moses, it's interesting you made that statement that they fear African men. One may well ask you, if we look at history, what would be the historical basis of fearing African men? because historically there's no history where African people in general have mutilated, enslaved, murdered, et cetera, a grouping of people that we call European. So where would the fear come? Logically, it seems like the fear should come from African people, should be more fearful of European people based upon their behavior towards them. So what is the basis of this fear?
The fear comes from the top. It's not your everyday necessary. It's not, it manifests itself in with everyday people, but it comes from the top. The ruling class is saying these people are revolutionary. If they have their way, we are doomed, and we've got to do something to stop it. We have got to stop them from getting empowered. We got to stop people from listening to them. We got to do everything we can to jail them, do whatever we can, because sooner or later, black skin cannot be free without white skin being free. And they know we are organizers. We are the revolutionaries. We have been historically rebelling, poisoning, killing, doing whatever we can to fight slavery and this injustices throughout history. It's documented with rebellions. You know, it's a culture. The ruling class is still the ruling class, and the culture is still the culture until it changes.
I think we have to give Francis Cross Wells and Crescent Theory, you know, some props when we talk about this question in terms of insecurity as it manifests itself among so many white folks who are in and out of the ruling class. I think one of the things that when the first thing they came to Africa is that what they discovered that these black people were extremely intelligent. They were pretty industrious, and they managed to coexist in a manner that was very relatively peaceful. So I think to some extent, when you look at the history in terms of how African people are betrayed, none of that is rarely that ever discussed. To the extent that you can find any kind of writings pertaining to the kind of society that exists in Africa prior to slavery, you have to look long and deep in terms of finding that history. And the question is, why do they obscure that history? Now, clearly, white folks benefit in terms of obscuring that history in the sense that you can paint African people as somehow brutish and therefore somehow akin to animals, and so therefore their enslavement is sort of almost a natural action. You could do that. But on the second hand, when just in terms of how human beings operate, one of the things is that when we talk about consciousness, one of the things, you can suppress some things you can suppress in your mind, you repress. Other things, it's very difficult to repress. Other things stay with you that actually enters in your consciousness. And so there's a notion in terms of keep on talking about the difference between quote-unquote white folks and African folks seems to be something that's a constant concern of white folks. And the question is, why are they so preoccupied with skin color? What does that mean? What is this preoccupation with skin color? To the extent that even when you talk about colonial America, we would define in terms of 17 different skin tones. I mean, that's preoccupation with skin color. And it has more to do with economics. It has to do with something, there's something, in fact, that's fundamentally lacking in themselves that they see in African people, which creates a certain amount of insecurity. So I think that if, in fact, normally if you, with those saying that, there's old saying that says that you normally emulate, those who impress you most are the people that you emulate. I've got the exact saying in terms, the exact saying, but it's something to the extent that those you admire the most you tend to emulate. And so it's interesting, on one hand, you have all these negative terms to define African people, but on the other extreme, you want to be just like African people. So it speaks to a kind of insecurity.
Schizophrenia?
No, not schizophrenia. Not schizophrenia. Not schizophrenia. But the fact that if I got a great deal of respect for you, if I idolize you, all right, then it doesn't manifest itself in terms of me complimenting you unless I'm secure myself. If I'm insecure myself, what I'm going to do, I'm going to put you down. You get my point? And so therefore, this nature in terms of constantly putting African people down is indicative of something. It's indicative of the insecurity, which is beside the question in terms of economics. So I think the question of insecurity is something that that white folks have to deal with. I think that Dr. Hecker, he's a political science guy who wrote, I've got the book that he wrote, but he wrote a book And one of the things he talked about, like how white people stand around and watch African people dance and admire the way African people move their body and wish they could be that way. And on the one hand, to somehow disparage African people by calling them loose, sexually immoral, blah, 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 on one hand, but on the other hand, secretly saying, man, if only I could be like them. So I think that it's a question that, that I think white society has to deal with. I think most whites are not prepared to even acknowledge that. Some will. Some inadvertently acknowledge that, while others won't. But yet, this resistance in terms of denigrating African people continues. But on the other hand, you know, trying to be like African people. So I think it speaks to insecurity, and I think it has a lot to do in terms of skin coloring. And I thought, and I also realized that one of the things is that one of the things that irritates white people to no end, most white folks anyway, is that when we talk about people of color, it irritates most white folks because you're saying that they don't have color. And I think it's a source of contention for a lot of white folks because in their mind, maybe they perceive themselves as colorless and therefore something that's lacking or something that's missing. And so therefore tend to reject or take their aggression out on, against African people simply because they have something that makes them complete. So I think that's something that we'll continue to discuss and something that I think has some legitimacy.
I'm just saying you have to recognize the class struggle, that these things, these ideas that are in society that people are thinking and behaving like addicted to cigarettes, addicted to alcohol, whatever, this comes out of class struggle, and there's a 1% at the top that's perpetuating this system, and it's an ideological and political system.
Let me just say this, Brother Anthony. Let me just conclude with this real quick and respond to Brother Moses. The class question is a legitimate question, and nobody's going to liquidate the class question because it's a legitimate question in terms of human behavior. But one of the things I think we have to begin to ask ourselves, if in fact we talk about the 1% who manipulate the rest of the white folks, why are poor white folks, by and large, buying into the rhetoric, the racist rhetoric that the 1% put out there for them to endorse? The question is that if it has no legitimacy in your mind, then it shouldn't really affect you to the point that you're willing to carry out the agenda of the 1%. So I think at some point we have to begin to ask ourselves that if it's purely monetary in terms of the way people behave, then why are poor white folks out here living in shacks with no food to eat, you know, struggling? Why would you embrace racism? It doesn't make any sense.
Because it's not purely an economic question. Largely economic, but it's also a political and ideological question. And I'll try to explain that. And for that, you have to look at the history of African and European relations.
Exactly.
Africans were not always regarded as inferior, and Africans around the world weren't always at the bottom in terms of economic, technological, or social progress. As a matter of fact, there were periods in history, long periods in history, where there were African states that were major political powers, were major players on the world stage. You would have to go back prior to the Maafas to actually find that. But with the advent of the European Renaissance during the 15th century and their discovery of the resources and wealth of Africa and the Western Hemisphere, in order to get the Europeans to cooperate in this super exploitation of cheap African labor, cheap, not free, cheap, they had to build this whole a whole set of sciences, ideologies, and philosophies to justify that exploitation of Africa. Recall that at the time of the European Renaissance, most Europeans were Christians or Hebrews, or practiced Judaism. So they had to, human beings aren't inherently exploitative of one another. That has to be justified. And there was a whole system of knowledge built up to justify the exploitation of Africans in the Europeans' mind so that they would do the things that they did. Now, I want to share with you an observation by Nkrumah. Nkrumah pointed out that even though the ideology of a society comes from one particular class, it seeks to unify everybody in that society towards common goals or aims. And this partly accounts for the way Africans in the U.S. behave toward one another and the way Europeans behave among themselves and and towards Africans and the American Indian, for that matter. Because the ideology of your society comes from the European bourgeoisie, which may only represent a small segment in physical numbers in that society, but because it is the ruling class, it seeks to impose its way of thinking on everybody else.
That was
if the material motive is all about access to material things, then certainly there's a benefit in terms of participating in the platitudes or the policies or the ideas of the ruling class. If in fact you benefit, if you don't benefit, then materially it's hard to make the case that in fact that there's some benefit. I mean that you should actually participate in whatever the ruling class does because there's some material benefit. But yet, Let me finish. I hear your argument about economics, and that's fine. I'm raising something different now. And we'll continue to discuss this because it has to be discussed. And the point is, I understand that you're making the point that it's ideological, and that's all in good. And to some extent, I'm agreeing. But let's just go back to something that Anthony says. Brother Ebony says that when we talk about advanced African civilizations prior to the enslavement of our people, that it's not like white folks weren't privy or didn't know that history. They know the history. But historically, I mean, I can understand in terms of, destroying that history in an attempt, to justify slavery. But what I can't understand in contemporary times, even in the 21st century, why do you persist in terms of making sure that people don't know that history? The bottom line is that in terms of our enslavement to the system, there's no question about it. That's done. They got everything in place in terms of making it possible for us not only to be marginalized, but to be exploited ruthlessly. So they got everything they want in place. So really, this kind of notion in terms of portraying African people as somehow, brutal, or somehow inhumane or somehow animalistic, like, is something that really makes, to me at this point in time, in point of history, it makes no sense because you already achieved essentially what you wanted to achieve. So that's the point that I'm raising. So unless you can demonstrate to me materially how a poor person and why a poor white person in society benefits from internalizing the values of the broader society, then I still say the economic argument is a good argument, but it doesn't totally explain what's going on in terms of social phenomena.
I think it does. In order for the bourgeoisie to maintain its control, it has to compel, a majority of the working class to work in its interests. Now the bourgeoisie does not have enough numbers physically to do that all by itself. So it has to co-opt that other 99% to work in its interests. And it does that through ideological control. And even though economics provides the material base, at root the problem is ideological and political. And the thing about it, though, a lot of your police, your soldiers, your military, et cetera, come from the working class, not from the bourgeoisie. The bourgeoisie controls them. So in order to get large segments that are not part of the bourgeoisie to work in the interest of the bourgeoisie, you have to exert control over their thoughts and actions, and that's done through propaganda, media control, et cetera, education
exactly.
system,
exactly.
and they do it that way. So that people who should naturally be allies of each other are instead enemies.
Exactly. Because like,
let me try one more time.
Cigarettes.
Go ahead, Bobby.
Yeah, I'm here.
He had a point you wanted to make?
You know, I appreciate all of the responses in regards to my initial query, and, you know, I think that definitely has a lot of validity, because one thing that you notice now in regards to this whole issue of race and all the dynamics that surround the issue of race, a lot of the time those that are bamboozling people aren't the people that don't look like us, but they are the people that look like us, because I just want somebody to chime in if they notice. I don't know if anybody has had the time to look at how Don Lemon from CNN, who happened to be a person of color, would respond to a situation in Ferguson, because he has a way of agitating those that are protesting in regards to injustice done, or he tried to make little pop shots and comics to belittle what's going on. I just want that response, you know. Why is it that all of a sudden we have this class of educated black folk, and that's what they want to do? They want to get those positions where, as Malcolm say, hoodwink, bamboozle, mislead the people, and lead them astray. So they have so much influence that they can use in a positive manner, but it's like they want to be part of that black misleadership class, and, you know, it's like it's a comfort in it. You know, I just don't see it personally.
Well, that goes again to ideology. In other words, the purpose of the educational system is to get those people to think in the interest and to think like the bourgeoisie. That's why you have so many educated Africans that have bourgeois aspirations, because that's what the education system is trying to do, is to get people to think like, you know, the European bourgeoisie, even though they're not a part of it, but to have those aspirations and to have the illusion that if they follow a certain track or a certain path, they could become a part of that. That's where you get, you know, the African misleadership class from. Because they're the ones who got all the A's and B's in the college courses, who went on to grad school, got their master's, doctors, and PhDs. And as a result of you know the influence of those bourgeois ideas, they've become estranged from the people that they might have came out of. Carter G. Woodson deals with that pretty well in Miseducation of the Negro.
Obama's a living witness.
Yeah, but there is a material basis in terms of the black petty bourgeoisie participating in oppression. I mean, in return for being a pawn for the powerful, they get money, houses, cars, and so forth, so on, status. So those kind of things they get. But I think to make the case that in terms of when you talk about poor Africans in the society, I mean, who are subsisting, the appeal in terms of how the system has less of an appeal. But really, that's no material basis to embrace a lot of the views, you know, emanating from the ruling class. And so, again, the question in terms of who should be most susceptible to those ideas by the ruling class, is it people who stand in inculcating those ideas, or is it people who have nothing in the world to gain from internalizing those ideas?
We have to free ourselves from mental slavery, And, like, it's in the streets that it's getting done. It's in the streets that you can tell where unity is being forged or not.
All right. Let's not necessarily get off this course, but let's take you to a take a left turn on it. Brother Zubari raised the issue. We were talking about how they have different rules and laws as relates to people in sports. And we understand that when we look at sports, it's a microcosm of society in general, particularly when we talk about the question, the issue around the issue of race. Just continuing in the earlier sports, I want to just tie this into his earlier story of what is going on. That is, you know, did we ever pay attention to how they dealt with DeSean Jackson, who was a wide receiver for the Philadelphia Eagles this past year? He was up for a new contract, and he was asking for X amount of dollars. And instead of receiving the X amount of dollars, which he solely deserved based upon his past performances, they picture him and paint him as a thug, someone who is involved in gangs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, with no fundamental proof. While at the same time, he had a teammate who openly displayed a behavior of being very, very racist and anti-African. And for being anti-African and very, very racist, he ended up getting a 2-day suspension with pay, and he got a raise. Many people felt like he should have been kicked out of the football team, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the one who got the bad end was the one who never got into trouble, the one who never displayed any harmful intent against another group of people, and he got labeled, and he was traded. How do y'all explain that phenomenon in terms of how they handled that case? Now, for those who are familiar with it, I'd like for y'all to speak on that. Brother Jabari, yes, you start off.
Well, clearly, you're looking at a multitude of issues, and one of the things that, unfortunately, given the context of where it was kind of dismissed in regards to the comment. Don't get me wrong. Anytime, you know, you have this guy calling black people, this white guy who was a football player calling black people a bunch of niggas and threatening to fight them for no reason, there's clearly a serious issue right there.
It's not a rally.
Yeah, he said that, but he was at a, notice though, he was at a country music concert, you know, honky-tonk concert, if you will, so notice that a lot of those people in that environment agree with him, so that had to come from his heart, because he's in a situation where there wasn't going to be any backlash. So that's the first thing to notice, and then in regards to the team, we have to remember that a lot of these owners of the team don't look out for our best interest. Sure, that's Philadelphia, mostly black city. But that ownership doesn't necessarily concern itself with the issues of the black public at large because, you know, I know there were fun in NFL teams as well because it always amazes me. The quarterback is always seen as the brains of the team. Like, if there was a military, they'd be the general, the brains of the team. But, you know, you can have so many teams in mostly black cities, but they will not give any opportunity to black quarterbacks. And it always makes me wonder, why is that? But, you know, I'm not surprised. Like you said, with the issue of race, you know, you want the face of the team to be that guy you promote and be whatever the dominant culture is. So, you know, it doesn't surprise me. And it's just a reminder that they want black people to be inferior status.
We have a Supreme Court justice using an innocent black man as an example of why there should be a death penalty.
Now, what Supreme Court judge was that? I missed that one.
That was Scalia when he was talking about those brothers that just got out of jail years ago. He was using them as an example of why there should be a death penalty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and those brothers won 30 years ago.
He's still sitting on the Supreme Court there. He's still on the Supreme Court.
Yeah. But that question that you raised, Brother Africa, in terms of the treatment of DeSean Jackson in Philadelphia, I think it's just the epitome in terms of how they see, you know, African athletes anyway. I don't think they particularly see African athletes as, you know, really valuable, you know, members of society as more like, you know, beast of burden, you know, people who can run and jump and that kind of thing. So I think that just the initial the notion that somehow, that if the allegation is that somehow the brother was a gang member, then he must be a gang member, because after all, black folks are gang members. You know what I mean? So you got this kind of bizarre kind of reason that it exists in the mind of so many of these owners in NFL. So I'm not surprised that in terms of offenses committed, that clearly the allegation of being a gang member weighs much harsher than it being a devout racist who's willing to fight innocent people simply because you have some animus against a particular group. So I think that's just part and parcel in terms of not only – I think, and also one of the things that's very interesting when we talk about that is that when you sit down and look at football, one of the things that's very interesting is the characterization of the athletes. This notion, and I remember as a kid growing up, this characterization that somehow white folks are always intelligent, you know, they make intelligent plays and very astute, very heady, you know. But Africans do the same thing, but the reception of a particular play is something totally different. It's like, well, you know, well, they did something good, they did something right. It's not spectacular, it's not intellectual, it's not heady. It's such as something that's sort of natural for these people, not that they're particular thinkers, but it's just that they just had a physicality. So I think it's a treatment is just part and parcel, you know, in terms of how they see African athletes overall. And I think to some extent, African athletes have to take some responsibility, because here it is, a league that's 70% African, that you do nothing in terms of creating a different paradigm in terms of NFL to make sure that a lot of these atrocities, a lot of these injustices that are inflicted upon African players will cease to exist, because you got the power to do it. But you don't have the mindset or the sense of organization to even, you know, begin that discussion. So as a consequence, African athletes pay the price. And even though they make a tremendous amount of money, they have no real power because they have no organization.
I think you hit two key things on the head, Haki. Lack of organization, and also, again, it seems like throughout this discussion, we keep coming back to the role that ideology plays. In other words, which is really the way people think, and how to such a degree that is controlled by the ruling capitalist class of this society, and it even goes deep into our levels, entertainment, sports, etc. And the root of that problem is that Africans aren't organized to really oppose or even defend their own interests today.
And I want to add to the discussion in regards to black athletes. I'm sure several of you are probably familiar with the case of Muhammad Abdul Rauf. I can't remember his name prior to his Islamic conversion, but anyhow. Brother Muhammad Abdul Rauf.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. But Brother Muhammad Abdul Rauf, because he was fed up with the injustices that we see on a daily basis, whenever the national anthem would play, he did this to himself, because he said he wasn't going to get his teammate involved, but he would, you know, quietly say his prayer to himself as a silent protest. But for whatever reason, the former commissioner of the NBA, David Stern, decided to basically, you know, for several years, blacklist this guy from the league, and he's one of the better ball players in his prime. And they did let him back sometime later, but it was amazing. That was after his skills greatly diminished and he didn't have necessarily the same impact that he did. And, well, for Craig Hodges, he wasn't even so fortunate, because once they got rid of him from the NBA, for when he presented former President Bush with the letter saying this is how the black community can be improved, his whole team sold him out, brother. They just sold him out completely, you know, as if they never knew the guy. As if he wasn't one of the best shooters to ever play in the NBA. You know, that speaks volume in itself, doesn't it, brothers? Looks just like him. He sold him out.
It does. And the thing about it, African athletes, unfortunately, lead a fishbowl existence. What I mean by that is everything you do, and all African entertainers in general, lead a fishbowl. In other words, everything you do as an entertainer athlete is magnified, considerably. I mean, disputes with your spouse, is blown out. I mean, if you get into a fight with somebody, that everything gets played in the media. And what happened to Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf is that, and that was about around the occasion, around the time the September 11th incidents took place, and there was a surge of patriotism among Europeans, if you will, and those Africans that buy into the system. And it was the media that pointed out that that Abdul-Rauf was not standing during the playing of the national anthem, and that's when the attention started focusing on him, that he was not doing that. He erred by using a religious argument when it was really a political one. When he made the religious argument that what the U.S. is doing, was against the principles of Islam, they found a Muslim to refute it, Hakim Olajuwon, who says that Islam teaches that you're loyal to the country that you are a citizen of. And so Abdul-Rauf was correct in the position he took, but he erred in his reasoning behind it.
Well, I'm not sure. It depends on who you're talking to in terms of the religion of Islam. I mean, there are clearly those Muslims who would not elevate anything above the Creator. So in that regard, he was absolutely correct. I mean, the whole thing was that, listen, I don't want to give homage to some flag or some country, because it's not greater than the Creator. And so, therefore, you don't honor it. So there are those in the Islamic community who understands that, who also agree. Other like Hakeem Olajuwon, of course he's going to say whatever they want him to say, because he's from Nigeria. He's making money. I mean, so he's not going to even if he agreed with Rauf, he's not going to say it. I mean, that's just ain't going to happen. I mean, he's just making too much money. He's got opportunity to do some things back home in Nigeria. So, but I think that if this country is as diverse as we like to believe, that perhaps that people would in fact would do a little investigation in terms of Islam, the tenets of Islam or the principles of Islam, and understanding where Rauf were coming from. But that's not the issue. The issue is that in this country, it's all about being in line. And to the extent that we talk about ideology. Clearly, there's only one way of doing things in society, and that's the American way. And if anything is perceived as "quote unquote" the un-American way, then we have to step on it. So clearly, that's what happened, and that's what Rauf got himself caught up into. But I think fundamentally, what he did in terms of not elevating flag or country over the Creator, I think it's a just one.
And I would like to add this point to this discussion. Also, when any time an African athlete take a stand or do something in opposition to the norm, he is setting the precedent for others to influence them. So therefore, they don't want these Africans to have any kind of positive influence, or particularly among the young peers who may be coming along. So in terms of that, they will always be ridiculed and chastised, because the whole point is you're brought there to be a gladiator, just to perform, and nothing else. You don't supposed to have the ability to think. They don't want you to set no kind of trend, no kind of symbolism, et cetera, et cetera. So I think this was another reason why the brother was dealt with the way you were dealt with, or any African in general, it was an African who take a position.
And, Brother African, let me add to your point with a recent case. Richard Mendenhall was a Pro Bowl caliber running back for the Pittsburgh Steelers. And during that, I'm sure we all remember when all of a sudden, right before midnight, there was this thing about they finally got Bin Laden. Well, Brother Mendenhall went to Twitter and said that whether they got him or not, I refuse to celebrate anybody's death because that's morbid, that's inhumane, and, that's an insult because all of us have value in being human. Now, the funny thing about that is, as soon as he said that, he would have been due to get an extension, make some more money from the Steelers, but all of a sudden the Steelers ended up getting rid of him. and he ended up in the Arizona Cardinals for a season or two. But the one thing that we can respect about Brother Mendenhall is that after he played with the Cardinals, he said that I've made my money. You know, I got to take care of my body, and I'm moving on past the game of football. But nonetheless, he suffered that same fate because Pittsburgh cut ties because he took a political stance, and when they gave him opportunity to apologize for it, he didn't. It also hurt his pocket because there were certain endorsements that were taken from him because of the comments he made on Twitter, and not once did he apologize for
them. I mean, Jim Brown said it clearly. They are gladiators, no more than modern-day gladiators. And I don't think you say it any more clearly. And it's a large plantation system. They constantly get African athletes go against each other. But when Europeans do things, there's a whole new total set of rules. And most Africans on these teams, they see these things and they say nothing because they're all committed to what? As they say, getting paid. They give up their principles, they give up their humanity just for the so-called almighty dollar. Is this a slave or isn't it?
But you know, Mendenhall is absolutely correct. One of the things is that the idea that to celebrate death of anybody is not like something that's something that's morally attainable. I mean, you don't want to. It's something that you don't want to do. You don't want to take a life of anybody if you can help it. If you find yourself in situations in which you have to do that, then, you know, that happens. But to brag about actually searching for someone to kill them and to brag about it. I remember Obama sitting there talking about, you know, how we killed Osama bin Laden and Brooklyn. You know, now can you imagine somebody killing, let's say, Secretary of State? You know, but let's forget about that. What about the example of killing old journalists over the Middle East, cutting their heads off? Oh, that was just outrageous. I mean, it's inhumane. These people are barbaric. People are this. These people are that. So now the pendulum has swung. Now it's not a good thing to brag about cutting somebody's head off, but it's okay to brag about killing somebody. So the insanity, I'm just amazed by the insanity and the hypocrisy that exists in society and people's willingness to go along with it. And it's just amazing, I think.
And, Haki, can I just add to that point for the listening audience, give y'all something to think about? Recently, Joan Rivers, who just made a transition.
Oh,
can you listen? Can you check out the statements that she was making against the Palestinian people? And had no problem with them just being bombarded all over the world, just being bummed up and saying, you know, silly stuff like, you know, they deserve what they get. They shouldn't come out their house. All kind of things she was saying. And, you know, the world didn't say anything. They applauded it. This is just.
But can I address that point real quick, Brother Africa?
Yes, you can, brother.
If you don't mind.
Yes.
And you know what I would say, and you guys are all aware of this because you guys are definitely much older than me. But you know, when you're a comic, there's this BS idea of a double standard. So all Joan Rivers had to do is say, "Hey, excuse me, people. I'm saying this in the comedic context. You know, she does that goofy cackling laugh of hers. It's automatically dismissed. I'm not saying that's right. I'm not saying it's reprehensible." I'm just saying because of the society we live in, that's all she has to do is say, oh, this was clearly within a comedic context. I'm no political commentator.
Yeah, I mean,
it's a question. The point you raised, Dr. Jabari, is a legit question, legit concern. I mean, clearly, media comedy, really has no bounds. But the better comedians are better in terms of taking, you know, some situations and making a joke over it in a way in which it's not offensive and it's not horrendous. So I think
I agree with you.
It's a question of skill.
But always, the way I look at it, if a comedian does their job, they're telling the truth in a very unorthodox manner. It's not even so much you're trying to get a laugh. You're trying to get the message out there just in a non-conventional way.
Right. It's probably very good at social commentary without offending people. So, you know, it can be mm-hmm. done. It's a question of skills. So she may
I agree.
As skilled as she thought she was. So I think that's part of the problem in terms of why Tamar calls it crass and, obnoxious, because she wasn't very skilled in terms of craft.
But in this case, I think Hockey had nothing to do with her skills. She was just outright stating her political position outright, that they deserve precisely what they get. They're the ones who started all of this, and she had no feelings towards the killing of these innocent people. This was just cold. It was just cold-blooded, outright.
That's also an extension of her history as well, because we know with Joan Rivers, her and Lisa Lampanelli, it's a couple of white comics, but that's what they do. They have these racist jokes that take shots at people of color, you know. Some people just say, oh, that's just them being them, even though I'm not saying we should ignore it or consider it condonable, but because that was part of her stick, nobody really paid it. Well, I won't say nobody paid attention to it. Nobody challenged her on how derogatory it was.
Well, Brother Africa saying, what's it in the context of any kind of comedic performance? It's just a general statement. Is that what you're saying, Brother Africa?
Yeah, she's all right. Just told a guy that, you know, they deserve what they get. She make a statement of her feeling, political position. And then it got people running around repeating stuff like, yeah, if they didn't come outside that door, see, if they would have just stayed inside like the Israeli government told them, they would never got bummed up. I mean, this is just crazy. How we can just look at humanity, one set of humanity, they have none, and another set of humanity, they have all the humanity. What kind of contradiction, what kind of craziness is this? But anyway, what we're going to do right now, you listen to Africa on the Move as your host, Brother Africa. We have a chat line up. You feel free to write in any comments that you'd like to have or questions. At the same time, if you are listening to the program and you'd like to have any comments, we are basically talking about what's going on. We'd like to have your perspective. You can do this by calling in at 323-679-0841. 323-679-0841 and press 1 if you have any comments or views you'd like to make. Again, our chat line is also open. Any questions or comments you'd like to make, we welcome you. This is an open forum tonight. We are addressing the question that Marvin Gaye raised 20, 30 years ago. What's going on with our political panelists, Brother Anthony, Jabari, Haki, and Moses? But we're going to take a break right now, pause for the calls. When we come back, we'd like to welcome our callers and listening audience to call in. Again, at 323-679-0841. Or hit us up on our chat line. But right now, let's just take a pause for the calls. We'll be right back.
Africa, the center of the world. Latitude zero. Longitude zero, planned by the Creator. Sisanthropus was the first man found on the earth. That earth was the motherland, Africa. We know that without total understanding of what happened in the past, it would be difficult to relate to the future. We know that within the structure of the music, there should be a message, and the message should be truth. So now, we give you Africa, the center of the world.
Africa.
would like to welcome you back to Africa on the Move. As your host, Brother Africa. We are discussing the topic tonight, what's going on. We'd like to invite you to call in to Africa on the Move at 323-679-0841. If you want to make a comment or you have a question, make sure you hit number one. At the same time, we have a chat line open. Feel free to go on our chat line and any questions you'd like to address, please feel free to do so. We'll attempt to address it. Right now, we're going to our next political panelist, Brother Haki. He's going to share with us what's going on from his perspective. Brother Haki, all yours.
Yeah, I tell you, I was amazed to hear Obama talk about committing $1 billion with a B to the so-called effort to destroy ISIS organization in the Middle East. Seems to me that, you know, whenever there's a need for resources when it comes to war, there's always the availability of all kinds of resources in terms of toward war. Now, I'm wondering why those resources are never allocated towards the real need right here in the country in terms of people that have access to jobs, affordable housing, quality education, health care. Why those kind of money never allocated toward the needs of people in society? So it seems to me rather odd that people talk about, in fact, America being a democracy, but in fact, nothing ever seems to filter down to the masses of people in terms of you know their needs, particularly when it comes to financing. So I'm just wondering what the panel think about that propensity to continue to spend money for war, but to spend nothing in terms of the citizens right here in the context of North America. I'm just wondering what the panel's view on that is.
What is oppression? There's going to be resistance, and the great Satan, the heart of the beast, or whatever you know, the beast itself, is not going to give up any resources that it has developed throughout history, and so. Where there's resistance, the oppressor always tries to tell you how you can resist, what forms, what tactics you can use to resist. He wants to dictate the terms of his oppression, and so what is Osama bin Laden was resisting, and there's an objective reality that he was resisting. Now, whether we like his tactics or not. There is a phenomenon that produces Osama bin Laden's that's going to continue to produce people in opposition to the U.S. government. Most revolutionaries are in opposition to the U.S. government. And there's a reason. And until those objective conditions are addressed and resolved, there's going to be resistance in one shape, form, or another.
I think what is happening is that with those beheadings being done publicly in the fashion they were, that upset the ruling bourgeoisie tremendously, and because that got played out all over the world. And it is typical of the Democratic and Republican parties to do whatever is in their power to protect the interests of the bourgeoisie. That is why there's an inordinate amount of resources allocated toward, military spending. Even though the U.S. is not under attack by anyone. But it's about protecting the interests of the ruling class, and that's what Obama represents today. And this escalation of the conflict in Iraq and Syria, the cost of that the labor behind that is going to be borne by the youth. And one of the things I'm curious about is how people feel about this escalation, of the conflict. In addition, in light of all the problems that that are internal to the U.S. But you see, there's a relation to it. It's a definite relationship.
But then, doesn't
well, you know, I'm glad that Brother Haki raised this issue, and as I listen to my fellow panelists offer their anecdotes, one thing that I've noticed in regards to those that are the oppressors is that they always want to manufacture situations where they feel that the people should feel that they are in need of them. So they create this idea of fear. So we be like, oh, the oppressor will protect us. Or even when it comes to our health care, you notice they manufacture all these illnesses so that we can back, all of a sudden we're addicted to, well, we're taking 10 to 15 different pills a day and 10 to 15 different pharmaceutical companies, you know, making big profits. So it's all connected. And I just see the pattern, you know, this create this thing, trying to create this dependency syndrome.
Hmm.
You know, the thing I'm wondering, what are the tangible benefits in terms of military intervention, you know, in the Middle East, in terms of Iraq and perhaps Syria? It seems to me that they're on a course which is going to actually demand that they actually contribute more money in terms of a war effort, not less. And so, therefore, if they're willing to commit potentially to large sums of money for war, then what is the value of this nation? What is the value of the people inside of the nation? Or does it have any value? So my thing is that it seems to me that the implications are very, very clear. That, you know, the only interest, as Brother Anthony alluded to, the only interest that really matter is the ruling on the 1%. So if in effect that is the situation, then how can people make the case that this is a democracy? So, and the percentage of people are still calling this a democracy. So I just find that extraordinary that would happen. Now, also, we look at a situation that happened in Russia, where they have all kind of blockades in place against Russia. But the thing is that nothing they do to Russia is really going to undermine Russia, in part because Russia has a relationship with other countries which need gas and oil. So they're not really making a kind of impact in which they're articulating. So all of this is really for public consumption. All this notion that, in fact, that we're on top of things, we control things, you know, we're in a position to punish people, it's just propaganda. It doesn't really mean anything, except to the extent that it means something, it means that it contributes to the overall deterioration of this economy. So the thing is that what I'm concerned about with this overall deterioration economy and giving large military expenditures, what are people going to do, you know, to the point where, where the unemployment rate is already unofficially close to 23% when it reached in excess of 50%. What are people going to do then, to the panel?
With war comes increasing militarization. And it seems like the only solution the ruling parties can offer is more war. And that means, in addition to the economic costs, there are the labor costs associated with it too. That I don't think that I don't think a lot of people are looking at. I mean, no matter how advanced your technology. Machines, including weapons, are operated by people. You need people to shoot those guns. And wars are lost and won by people fighting on the ground. And there's an aspect that I don't think people haven't given much thought to, is that typically in any war, it's the youth of the society that bear the brunt of that conflict. As a matter of fact, I think in the military, and I don't know this because I never served in, there's an age limit in terms of which you can be allowed to perform combat functions. I think it's 35, but I'm not 100% sure of that. So, I mean, so this escalation of the conflict going on in the so-called Middle East and elsewhere around the world has implications, I think, for the youth of our society. And we have mentioned other conflicts like escalation conflicts in Africa. And this is for the sake of gaining access to the limited resources that imperialism needs in order to sustain itself.
Okay, I believe we have a call online. Caller 9435. Question or comment, please. 9435. Okay, we'll come back to the caller.
Hello.
Caller,
yeah, I was just listening to your show. I just got on. I didn't have a comment per se yet.
Okay, caller, we'll come back to you later. Just hold on. Thank you. Brother Haki, you going to respond to your question that you raised the panelists about the wide allocation of all this money for wars. What do we get out of it? Why do they do it? I know one of the things I like to respond to that question, Brother Haki, is when you look at that capitalist economy, it's all about making money. You know, the military industrial complex is one of the largest complex in terms of generating large sums of money in terms of for a few people, in terms of when you're talking about wealth, particularly when you're talking about stealing wealth, you know. But with walls, you know, you manufacture and create different types of jobs. But other little smaller sectors benefit from it also. So, you know, I think when I was taking economics classes when I was in school during that time, I think they would say historically, you look at U.S., they have like a reciprocal cycle where maybe every 20 years or so, U.S. finds itself into a war because, you know, basically that's how they have structured their economy. So for us, I would think that when we look at the reason why they invest much money in this particular in walls is just the way how they, I would say, legalize steal money. That's where a large sector of your criminals. And that's the bottom line in terms of how I see that, in terms of not only taking money but also taking people resources and land and continue to perpetuate, you know, fighting among people so they can maintain the benefit from the fight. Not only do they give resources to one side, but they give to both sides a lot of time to fight each other, to play both sides against each other. So anyway, for me, it's just we're making more money for a small sector of folks. This is where we rob the treasury of this country from the people.
Yeah, but you know, the irony is, though, Brother Africa, is that when you talk about the military-industrial complex, clearly, I mean, represents a large slice of GDP in terms of the overall economy. But the thing is that the irony is that even though they give them tens of billions of dollars, you know, on a quarter basis, the problem is that you got a tax structure in which their tax rate or the effective tax rate is relatively low. So these people in all actuality end up paying 13%, something like 13% in terms of taxes. So when you look at most industrial societies, you know, the people pay tax rate in excess of 35%. So clearly in the United States, people pay less for taxes. So to me, it doesn't make a whole lot of economic sense to give people large sums of money and then turn around and tax them less, which means it becomes a drain on the overall economy. And the problem is that because society needs money to run on, people need school, people need housing, people need education, people need all these things, but it takes money in order to do that. So it seems to me this is just this creative destruction in terms of the monetary attributes of any society doesn't bode well in terms of the overall function of the economy. It seems to me that you render a lot of people existence on this planet as esoteric simply because you don't have any any way in terms of providing or providing for people, not in the literal sense of providing, but to the extent that jobs are viable, that the economy is viable, that people have access to education or people have health care, to access to health care and so forth and so on. So it seems to me a very strange irony, but I will agree with you that they do play both sides of the middle. So one of the things a lot of people don't understand is that a lot of this ISIS organization that currently exists was in fact created by the U.S. 4 years ago, which they exercised. They went through all kind of exercises, and they got their training in Yemen. In Jordan 4 years ago. So they were financed, you know, by the U.S., by the proxy, Israel, in terms of getting the money to them. So clearly they're playing both sides against the middle. I mean, clearly for strategic reasons, they finance these so-called, quote-unquote, terrorist groups and then come back and tell American people, so see, you got charged, so we had to spend tens of billions on a quarterly basis every 3 months in order to fight them. And it is amazing to me in the 21st century, people still going for that okey-doke. But I think the much broader question I'd like the panel to address is the question in terms of what did that fundamentally mean to the lives of to people generally in the society if they don't have access to money, opportunity, food, shelter, quality education, so health care, and so forth and so on. What does that fundamentally mean for their lives? I don't think a lot of people in the society have figured that one out yet. I think they think that this kind of arrangement can go on indefinitely and without any consequences. But clearly, when we look at the unemployment rate unofficially at 23%, then clearly, when we look at inflation or even the misery index, which conflates unemployment with inflation, and which is called the misery index, and we look at how it's been rising over the last 15 years, then clearly something is seriously wrong. And just in terms of the kind of money they spend, there's no indication whatsoever that they're willing to even to address these issues as it impacts on human beings and society. So my question is, what does all of this spending mean to the people in this country? And if people don't have access to money in terms of the kind of things they need, then what choices do they have in terms of their own existence, their own longevity in the society? What choices do they have?
The only choice is to organize. Let's see, as in capitalism intensifies, which is what we're seeing now, as things intensify, it creates the situation where there's surplus labor, where labor no longer has the ability to consume what it produces. That's one of the holes it digs for itself, as it digs its own grave, because capitalism becomes increasingly unsustainable by humanity, not to mention by the planet, because along with the exploitation of the workers, you have the degradation of the environment, which causes all kinds of problems across the earth, around the world, and even the people that pursue an advanced education beyond high school, they have trouble getting employment, which utilizes the skills that they allocated all these resources to acquiring, and therefore they have to settle jobs that don't compensate them enough to handle the debt they incurred to get their degrees. I saw a news story on this earlier before I called in about how some college students are having trouble finding work that are commensurate with with their skills. And I think to a certain extent, wars are a limited solution. But if it weren't for all the military interventions going on right now, let's see, the unemployment in the U.S. would be even higher than what it is.
We have some hard choices to make. There's opportunism within the working class movement. For instance, this Keystone Pipeline, you know, offers jobs. It's a lot of jobs. But should we be doing it? It's a no-brainer to me. We should not be doing it. It's destroying the planet. But, you know, the jobs, it's about jobs and income, but it's about choices about what you will and won't do, and that requires a political consciousness. And that's our main task, is to raise the conscience of the people so that they won't follow lockstep when Obama says we're going to do this and we're going to do that. They just don't fall in line like the Hitler's stormtroopers or something.
I think for me, Brother Hackey, what those choices are doing to the people here is putting them in a position where they become voluntarily again enslaved again. They head to the prison system, and they're using this economic means of creating desperate situations to cause you to, quote-unquote, commit crimes under pretense of crimes. That's where you end up, where you become a free worker or doing free labor for the state again. That's one of the consequences, I think, in terms of how it's playing out and manifesting itself.
But you know, one of the problems is that a lot of the prisons are like at 2% capacity, 2,000% capacity. So a lot of these prisons are bulging at the seams. So it seems to me there's a fundamental problem. One is economic, namely law of diminishing returns. I mean, you spend money, lots of money in terms of incarcerating people, but it's simply an arrangement that's not sustainable. So the question is that, as you alluded to, that you're going to have more and more people out of hopelessness and despair committing crime and all kind of things just to survive. And so the question is, what is the response of the system? What are they going to do when that situation, and it's getting to that, and it's getting critical now. It's quickly reaching a pinnacle where people actually feel like they got nothing to lose. So what are they going to do with this large number of people in which, you know, in order for the system to maintain, you know, its equilibrium, he's got to find some kind of way to deal with all these people it simply can no longer afford to incarcerate. So the issue is, what is it going to do then?
Incarcerate some more, and then start executing them through different forms of some people call it genocide, but they'll find different ways to execute them through incarceration. That's what I would say.
Yeah. Well, I think a step forward. I think that the only realistic solution for them is you're right, further incarceration, but not in the traditional sense. We talk about prisons, but we talk about a way to incarcerate, which is relatively economically expedient, which would be the utilization of concentration camps. So I think in terms of the American population, is a real option. So I think so. When Obama talks about extending the National Defense Authorization Act, where you talk about interment a U.S. citizen given the situation, I think they're very, very clear on the point that hopelessness in society is growing, and they got no intentions on addressing the hopelessness and despair. In fact, the ultimate solution for them is simply to intern a large number of people in the system in terms of maintaining control. So I'm just wondering what other people think about the question in terms of internment and whether they see that as being viable as far as the ruling class is concerned.
And to add to the point, this is why they're militarizing local police agencies
right
now, because they are
right
preparing for that. I don't know if people in real life, for over 20 years,
right,
for every precinct you have in these cities, all the cities, you also have a local police station that's basically been empty for 20 years but has been set in these communities.
Right.
The question becomes, why are they just setting in these communities?
What I think we see happening for people that are analyze our history carefully is that the U.S. is moving away from the welfare state, which it had been for the last commenced, 80 years ago with the end of the Depression, and it's moving toward fascism, which is the only way it can survive, because it cannot provide the services to sustain, its population. So it has to resort to fascism, and we see that in the militarization of the police, the heavy militarization overall, the taking away of the reforms that made life more bearable for the masses of the people, and also the erosion of so-called democratic rights in the name of security. So people are blind to it, but that's what's happening.
Okay, I'd like to make this brief announcement to the listening audience that you are listening to Africa on the Move. As Brother African, we encourage you to call in at 323-679-0841, or if you can go to our chat line and talk to us on that chat line. We basically have an open topic today. We want to know what's going on in your world, and we've been discussing some issues concerning what's going on in our world. And right now, we will take call to 9435. Welcome to Africa on the Move. What's going on in your world? Your question or comments, caller.
Thank you, Brother Africa. I was listening to your program, and it seems that most of your commentators are basically identifying problems and issues that are all interconnected. They're not separate issues by themselves. I think that there's a number of others that could be added to the list that people are discussing on your program there today. However, I think that it's good that you look at some of them. The question of mass incarceration and genocide, the question of AFRICOM imperialism versus Pan-Africanism, the question of neocolonialism and the compliancy of some of our leaders with our enemy system, the question of the killing of Mother Earth, which without Mother Earth, none of us will survive. So I think that that one is also very important to all the others, because without saving the Earth, we have no chance of surviving, and everything else becomes a moot point. I am glad to see the quality of speakers you have today and their ability to really address all of these basically very fundamental problems. I think that your program lends a great service to the community, and I'd just like to stop there and continue listening.
I call, can I just get one quick response from you? Can you share with the audience your understanding of what is AFRICOM and how does that unchallenge Pan-Africanism, or what is the relationship to the two?
Well, AFRICOM is the U.S. Military African Command, or the U.S. Military Command for Africa, and it's a developing military division based out of Germany that is trying to implant itself on the continent somewhere. They already have a number of drone bases, and they're involved in a lot of what they're calling humanitarian projects, but they're really not humanitarian in any way, and most folks on the continent can see through their delusion and have been against this, however, because they have been able to pay off many neocolonial leaders. The leadership of countries in Africa have accepted this military command even to their own detriment, and like, you know, fools, they're not really aware of the total effect that this will have on their country and their people and their future. So AFRICOM is a very dangerous situation for Africa. And it's a situation in which many military groups in Africa are getting training, which they think is free training, but it's not. It's neocolonial training. It's like the training that the people in South and Central America get from the School of the Americas, now called WINSEC, where they go back to their countries and become death squads in the service of imperialism. So it is very dangerous, and it needs to be examined and understood and then fought against viciously.
And how do you equate that with the impact of Pan-Africanism or the threat to Pan-Africanism?
Well, neocolonialism is a threat to Pan-Africanism. And the role of AFRICOM currently is to suppress true liberation movements on the continent under the guise of fighting terrorism or under the guise of doing humanitarian work. And the other goal is to produce neocolonial agents that will control Africa towards the foreseeable future for U.S. imperialism and neoliberalism.
Okay, caller, we'd like to thank you for your contribution to tonight's program.
And thank you, and keep up the good work.
Okay, we thank you. Again, y'all listen to Africa on the Move. I'm your host, Brother Africa. And like we say all the time, if you define it, we'll stand behind it. We're in the seat, and we'll take the heat. But what we will always do, we'll speak truth through power. This is one of the characteristics of Africa on the Move. We like to view those things as it relates to not only our people's interests, but the historical relationship of issues that have had a profound impact on our present lives and future lives to be. So we'll continue the discussion, and our last caller raised a couple of issues with our political panelists tonight. One of the things I'd like to raise is if we could speak a little bit about the relationship of the so-called African leaders inside and outside the U.S. and the role that they are playing in terms of allowing these kind of policies or allowing these kind of issues exist that are not favorable to our people. Let's talk about the question of leadership, of African leadership today. How do people see this? We'll start with you, Brother Haki. Take a shot at that one first.
Well, when we talk about those who stand in opposition to our liberation, then clearly we have to include African, so-called quote unquote African leadership. And by the way, they're only leaders to the extent that they are magnified, you know, by the media or by social political institutions, which give them legitimacy. By and large, most of these people who are positions of power are not really legitimate to the extent that the masses of people support them, but they are leaders simply because they're designated as leaders simply because they have the eye of the media or they have certain social status, you know, upon them by the media. So we have to understand that precisely. Clearly, the role that they play is a very destructive one. I mean, they undermine the interests of African people. They undermine the interests of humanity generally in terms of the stance that they take. And as the brother alluded to earlier, one of the things when we talk about Africa and talk about the willingness in terms to capitulate, to go along with the Western policies, even though these policies are designed to undermine the economy, to destroy any chance of economic vitality, to literally liquidate large numbers of people, to destroy the economy. I mean, not such economy, but the ecology of the nation. So all these things go on, and despite all of these things, that you have African leaders who are willing, if they pay them, they are willing to acquiesce to Western demands, and it's ironic. One of the things when we talk about drones, we talk about Djibouti. Djibouti is the headquarters of Africa Central Command. They paid this guy, this president of Djibouti, they paid this guy $50 million to lease a large piece of land in Djibouti. $50 million a year. Now, $50 million is a mere pittance. It's no money at all in terms of running the country. But as the brother alluded to, the focus is not so much on the interests of the people or developing the country, it's about how much money they can put in their pockets. And this is a sad commentary as it relates to a lot of African leaders. And having said that, keep in mind, there's no difference in terms of African leaders right here in the context of America. All these congressmen, these senators, these mayors, these representatives in the state houses, none of them serve the interests of people. They don't certainly don't serve the interests of African people. Pretty much they're locked into a system in which their mandate is essentially carry out the mandates of that system without regard to how adversely impacts on the health, the well-being, or the longevity of its people. Because the focus is not in terms of people. The focus is in preservation of power among the powerful. It's all that is. And so one of the things that we keep talking about, if we just vote, then it's going to change things. Well, I've been voting for a long, long time, and even though at least historically speaking, we have many, many members in state houses. We have an unprecedented number of Africans in Congress and the Senate. We have an African who's in the White House. But yet it doesn't translate into anything meaningful in terms of meaningful policy in the sense that it impacts in a positive way toward African people and or humanity generally. So the notion that somehow we just vote, something that is articulated by people like Al Sharpton, that we just vote, then it's going to be all right, is indeed disingenuous. I think some people have to realize that voting is not a solution, that in fact, the only thing you can really do in terms of participating in a system is to endorse a system. And if you endorse a system, can you seriously do anything that's going to really help or empower the masses of people? You certainly cannot. So this is a problem that we confront in terms of corrupt leadership that exists not only in this country but throughout the world when it comes to African people. So it's a struggle that we have to wage, but first and foremost we have to understand objectively who our enemies are, and they're not all white. So we have to understand exactly what that means.
President Moses, would you like to take a stab at this question of African leadership and how they participate in these contradictions when it comes to the interests of our people? Are you there, Brother Moses? Okay, we'll come back with Brother Moses. We go to Brother Anthony.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry.
Okay. How are you, Brother Moses?
We've been having a good discussion tonight. I'm glad I was able to participate. The definitely Mother Earth, we definitely, as the brother was saying, we have to protect. Without the planet, there is nothing. There is. You know, we all go down, and so we should have our priorities straight. It should affect our everyday decisions, and like religion, it should be personal. It should be a personal relationship, and nobody but you can. Nobody can tell you what your religion is. That's a personal thing, and politics should be personal, and so we should have the consciousness. And to raise people's consciousness around us as to what needs to be done for there to be justice and fair play and throughout the planet.
Brother Anthony, in terms of leadership questions of Africans, matter of fact, you work with an organization called the All African People's Revolutionary Party, GEC. Recently, this past AID, the theme was dealing with the neocolonial intelligentsia. And being the fundamental contradiction at this stage of our development. Can you talk about that in that context of leadership?
Sure. Let's see. What we're struggling to do is to create the revolutionary intelligentsia. Intelligentsia that'll provide a genuine leadership for the masses of our people. The leadership that exists now, for the most part, only works in the interests of the bourgeoisie. That's all they care about. They really don't care anything about the mass of the people, even though they come from among them, and it was off of their labor and sacrifices that they were able to obtain the positions that they do have. But they're not the true leadership of our people. It has to come from among our people, and as a result of revolutionary political education and organization. The leadership is for the most part, been educated in educational institutions that are controlled by the bourgeoisie, including much of the political leadership on the continent. And that is why, Africans worldwide suffer from neocolonial domination today. Because you have leadership that looks like you does not necessarily mean that it represents your interests. And as we've discussed tonight, in most cases it does not represent our interests. And what we're struggling to do is to create that group of that core of cadre that can organize, the leadership that'll organize the people to bring about their liberation, their own liberation, because it's something that we have to actualize ourselves. It cannot be done from outside, and no other people can do it for us.
Okay, Brother Zabari, would you like to take a position on this question of leadership when it comes to African leadership and the role they are playing or not playing as relates to fulfilling the interests of the masses of our people?
Something that greatly disappoints me is that you'll be amazed at the number of black people in the U.S. that are either ignorant to what AFRICOM is about or have no issue with what it's about, its platform, and how it's hurting, the mother continent. Because I know it wasn't that long ago, there's this award program, the Trumpet Awards, that comes on every year. And I remember, I think you may remember me sharing this with you, Brother Africa, but I was very much outraged and disappointed that one of their designees was one of the guys that was one of the generals for AFRICOM, an African guy, I can't remember his name. Nonetheless, it just made me that you have this very destructive force, and you have a predominantly African awards program that's been around for the last 20, 30 years, and they felt reason to give this guy some type of special distinction. And, I noticed the contradiction, but it just amazed me that those bourgeoisie and pseudo-bourgeoisie, felt the need that he was doing us some great service, so they wanted to make a spectacle and recognize him.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, we have a few minutes left. We'll go to Brother Anthony. We'll give you a few minutes in reference to, are there any particular issues or concerns you'd like to share with the people? Well, what's going on? What perspective you'd like to share with our people?
Let's see. In addition to what we've discussed tonight, most schools throughout the U.S. are back in session now. And one of the things I'm concerned about is that the upheaval that took place this summer over the killings by the police of people such as Eric Garner and brother Michael and in various places throughout the U.S. you know, that people don't, you know, that people keep their guard up, even though, you know, school is back in session and people are probably preoccupied with their classes and what have you, that and their jobs, of course, that people don't forget about the events that took place during the summer, and that we intensify our level of organization in order to minimize that reoccurring in the future. But I think we have to be aware of what's going on around us. Let's see, as imperialism, you know, tries to maintain its control over the world, struggle is intensifying everywhere, and people are organizing to resist, this onslaught. And I think the question for us is what we are going to do to contribute to that process of liberating the planet from imperialism.
Brother Anthony, I can take this liberty based upon what you just said. I would like to make a statement to the listening audience and to the world. And I'd like my brother Haki come in and add some information to this particular issue that I'm going to raise for everyone since we only have a few minutes left. You know, Brother Anthony, you talk about this ongoing killing among our youth in these systems, and there seems to be a very, very outcry every time when we see a brother and sister innocently get assassinated. One of the things that was raised for me recently in terms of a case that I have been dearly involved in as an advocate, dealing with one of our youth, his name is Michael Fortin, but unfortunately he hasn't got killed yet. Not yet, we hope never. But this brother has been innocently accused of committing a so-called crime by the use of using a computer, and they're trying to railroad him into the prison system. He's a graduate student, majoring in engineering, and he was on his way to become a productive citizen and to make his contribution to humanity. There seems to be that if the media doesn't talk about a case or take up of a case, we as African people don't have a sense of a willingness to
urgency.
We don't have a willingness to let what's worth for to give it its legitimacy, because it has not been told or been taken up by the media. This brother Michael Fulton right now is critically, his life is online in terms of the next 2 weeks or so, in terms of whether or not if he goes into the concentration camp, has been accused of committing a crime that he didn't do. What we like is an active appeal to our audience and those who get copies of our programs. Please mail this program out to your friends, and we ask you if you can do whatever you can to make a contribution so we can have this brother get the proper legal representation that he needs in order to prove his innocence. Based upon the research that we have done up to this point, we believe the brother's innocent, but because of the system, if you don't have money, if you are just accused, many times you'll be innocently put away. We try to avoid this. So on behalf of his mother, and I plead with Brother Michael Fulton, we're going to ask Brother Haki just to share some of the aspects of this particular case with our audience. Because later on, we will share this program with the rest of the world. We want you to see what you can do in terms of helping to make a contribution to this brother. And we'll tell you how you'll be able to do this later on. Brother Haki, can you talk a little bit just about this case of Michael Fulton and why it's important for us to not just rely on major media to add legitimacy to the well-being of our people and our youth?
Yeah, essentially, what's been happening over the last 5 years, the innovative technology, which is possible to use botnets, put on other people's computers malicious files. Unfortunately, a lot of times, you know, in the process of perusing the computer, you might click on something which you're just curious about. But to you, you end up making it possible for the files, you know, in your computer, which you're totally unaware of.
This brother apparently was a victim of malicious files, and so as a consequence, what's happening is that they're going after him. Now, here's the thing in terms of the politics. One of the things they want to do, aside from crime generally, they want to create this illusion that we have this menace, this pedophile menace, and so therefore, what they do is that they routinely target computers. And so what happens is that given the nature of the technology, the people who are actually responsible for creating those images on people's computers have the technology to evade law enforcement detection. Consequently, the people who don't have access to technology are the ones who end up in prison simply because in the process of perusing computers, those officials in law department and law enforcement departments see that file, and then that raid your house, and as a consequence, then you end up being arrested for having possession of certain kinds of inappropriate files on your computer. The problem is that it takes a lot of money in terms of proving your innocence. There was one case in Massachusetts where a guy was accused of that, but he had deep pockets, so he ended up spending like $200,000 just to clear himself. He needed a computer forensic analyst to prove that he didn't do it. It was impossible for him to do. Michael Fulton has a similar case. He needs the money in terms of getting a reputable computer forensic analyst to prove that he didn't do it. Without that reputable computer forensic analyst, this young brother is going to end up in prison. Make no mistake about it. I mean, he's a very intelligent African-American. So the thing is that he's the worst kind of threat to the power structure. And so therefore, they would like nothing better than to put him behind bars and totally destroy his career, his future. So this is the problem that we're confronted with, and we're trying to raise funds in terms of, so we get a reputable computer forensic analyst. We identify one by the name of Tammy Lors, who's probably one of the best analysts in the country. And we identified her, but it's a simpler question of raising the funds in terms of being able to get her. So we're gonna need about $8,000 in order to secure her services, and this is the fundamental problem we're confronted with in terms of the particular case. Now, people should be aware that even though it hasn't happened to you or your children yet, there's always a possibility that it could happen. And so no one should sleep easy and believe that, it'll never happen to me. It could quite easily happen to you. And the problem is that even the latest software in terms of virus protection doesn't protect you from these botnets. I mean, the technology is not sophisticated. So there are many ways in terms of affecting the system. So it's not that you can buy anything that's going to protect you 100%. And the thing is that the IT companies are well aware of what's going on, but the problem is it's a $1 billion-a-year business. So these wealthy pedophiles purchase this technology and end up using it to the detriment of literally hundreds of thousands of people all over the world. So this is the problem Michael Fulton is confronted with, and without that forensic analyst, then the probability is that he's going to spend a lot of time in prison.
And I'd like to add, as well as he still needs a reputable lawyer dealing with these court-appointed lawyers who are overworked and underpaid. They cannot give it proper attention. We talked to several lawyers who want to take the case. But again, it's a money question. So we ask in the community if you can send $5, $10, $15, $20 to Michael Fulton on behalf of his case. This is how you can find out more information. You can email them at saveoursons2013@gmail.com, or you can call his mother directly, Miss Katie Fulton. I will give you two numbers where you can reach her. First number is 720-499-5146, or you can reach us at 720-221-8500. This family is in need of your support, need your help. And even if you came or sent anything, still call them. Let them know that you are concerned about the case and how you can stay abreast of the case. Because without information, it's just like nothing exists. And because we don't have the kind of media that they have, it's become a very valuable tool that they can use against our people. So Tonight we are appealing on behalf of Michael to our listening audience and your friends in your network. When you get this program, will you please share that with your other friends in the network? We know there are some lawyers with good heart that may be willing to even come forward to help assist a brother and sister. All the time is not about money. It's about whether or not you will take the time and use your resource to advance and help your people. But in this case, it's a combination of both. We do need your help. So again, you can email SaveOurSons2013@gmail.com, or you can call the sister directly, Ms. Katie Fulton, at 720-499-5146 or 720-221-8500. You can go to any Wells Fargo bank and also ask that you can make a contribution to Save Our Son Defense Fund, Inc., and that money will go straight to the account to help Brother Michael Fulton. This young brother needs and deserves your support. Now, we only have a few minutes left. In closing, each person, I'd like to make a one-minute statement. Start with you, Brother Anthony, to our audience tonight.
Okay. One minute. Let's see. I would urge their listening audience and all our people in general to get organized, because that is the only way we'll be able to defeat our enemies, because our enemies are well-organized and well-financed. And we have to get organized so that we can channel our limited resources to our liberation and freedom. You can find out more about my organization through our website, www.a-aprp-gc.org. And you can contact us at info@a-aprp-gc.org. Do what you can to support Brother Michael Fulton and his family, and also join an organization that's working for our people's liberation.
Brother Jabari, 1 minute, please.
What I would say to the audience is something that I always advocate: be a student of history, because if you notice, there were several parallels between the Rodney King uprising and how they handled the situation in Ferguson when people protested, because I know we talked about the militarization of police, and people who were in California during the time of Rodney King mentioned that I was one of the first police forces where they actually would have a tank to roll through neighborhoods, or have other means of highly powered vehicles sometimes to come through to intimidate the people and create a certain sense of paranoia.
Brother Moses, can you give 30 seconds? We've got about 1 minute left before we go off the airways. Brother Moses.
Okay, I just want to say have a good evening. It's been great on the show tonight. It's been instructive, informative, and I hope you keep up the good work.
30 seconds, Brother Hackey.
As Brother Anthony said, get organized. The situation we're confronted with is a grim one, and if we don't get organized, it becomes problematic in terms of survival in society. So we need organization.
In closing, as your host, we'd like to let you know that this program is a project of the African Awareness Association. In order to receive information that you have heard today, you can also contact the African Awareness Association by emailing us at African_Awareness_Association@Yahoo, or you can call us at 804-549-7492. We'd like to invite our audience also this December, from December 18th to January 1st, to come and take a free ride trip with us to Cuba. If you're interested, give us a call or email us. Until next time, we'd like to thank you for watching Africa on the Move, and continue to let's grab to go forward ever, backwards never.
Latitude zero, longitude zero, planned by the Creator. Sizanthropus was the first man found on the earth. That earth was the motherland, Africa. We know that without total understanding of what happened in the past, it would be difficult to relate to the future. We know that within the structure of the music, there should be a message, and the message should be truth. So now, we give you Africa, the center of the world.